And welcome to this morning's showcase panel. My name is Morgan Larson, and I am the president of the Arizona State University chapter, and it is my privilege to introduce what may be one of the most remarkable gatherings of constitutional advocates in recent memory. The panel before you represents not only a lineup of brilliant legal minds, but the architects of some of the most consequential decisions of our era. Their cases have re-energized advocates of constitutional restraint. They have recaptured what was thought to be lost legal ground and helped correct course on what Justice Alito feared was a deep corruption of our legal culture's conception of constitutional interpretation. These fierce guardians of freedom refused to surrender to the fashionable distortions, and thanks to their tenacity, combined with the courage of their clients, we've witnessed a renewed fidelity to the text, structure, and history of our founding document, and with it, a sense of transtemporal stability to our most treasured freedoms. While this year marks the 20th anniversary of the Roberts Court, it appears that in many ways, this decade, the one we're in right now, the 2020s, will ultimately define its legacy. This decade is only halfway through, and already the court has handed down a series of historic rulings, from vindicating equal protection in Students for Fair Admission, to eliminating unwritten amendments in Dobbs, to throwing Chevron deference back into the sea in Loper Bright, and reaffirming the right to bear arms in Bruin, and preserving the state's historic dominion over health and welfare in Skrmetti. This morning's panelists were not merely observers to these developments, they were on the front lines. They stood at the lectern, they fielded the questions, and argued the cases that have shaped and will continue to shape our constitutional order. Today, they will reflect on these victories, the paths that led to them, and what may lie ahead for the Roberts Court. To help navigate this discussion, we are fortunate to be under the thoughtful guidance of the Honorable Catherine Kimball Mizell. Judge Mizell is a distinguished member of the federal judiciary, serving as a United States District Judge for the Middle District of Florida. Appointed in 2020, at the age of 33, she was the youngest Article III judge in the nation at the time of her confirmation. Before joining the bench, Judge Mizell practiced at Jones Day, served in several roles at the Department of the Judiciary, she has also taught at the University of Florida in Scalia Law. Judge Mizell earned her JD summa cum laude from the University of Florida and has clerked at every level of the judiciary, including for Justice Clarence Thomas on the United States Supreme Court. We are so grateful to have her leading today's conversation. And with that, I am honored to turn the program over to Judge Mizell to introduce the rest of these constitutional heavyweights.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me back this year. It's my honor and privilege to get to moderate this panel. I was asked to remind all, for the CLE credit, please scan your QR code on the front and the back before you leave today so you get that CLE credit. Okay, that duty is done then. A couple things. I'm no longer the youngest federal judge. I think Josh Devine, who's here, has taken that title, so congratulations, Josh. As the introduction said, this is the 20th year of the Roberts Court. It also marks the 40th anniversary of when Attorney General Ed Meese gave his historic speech calling upon the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution based on its original meaning. In the last 40 years, and in no small part due to many of those in the Federalist Society, the Overton window on how constitutional analysis is done has completely shifted. Justice Scalia first made us all textualists, and dare I say, Justice Thomas has now made us all originalists. And we now have a Roberts Court where everyone purports to be doing some form of originalism. That said, the justices have not coalesced about how to do originalism. It is true that the court has gravitated towards text, history, and tradition, sort of as the lodestar, but they don't all agree as to what that means and how to weigh each of those factors. Despite that lack of uniformity, though, our panelists this morning have had remarkable success in securing consequential victories across constitutional matters. We're going to discuss their litigation paths and the trends that they expect to see in the next few years on the Roberts Court. So first, we have Scott Stewart, who serves as the Solicitor General of the state of Mississippi, to discuss Dobbs. Scott formerly worked at the Department of Justice and at Gibson Dunn, and notably clerked for Justice Thomas. Next, we have Cameron Norris, a partner at Consovoy McCarthy, who's going to discuss Students for Fair Admissions. Cam also clerked for Justice Thomas. And then next, we have Paul Clement, the former U.S. Solicitor General and prolific litigator at the court, to discuss Bruin and Loper Bright. For diversity, he clerked for Justice Scalia. And finally, we have Matt Rice, the Solicitor General of the state of Tennessee, to discuss Scrimeti. Matt formerly worked at Williams & Connolly, also clerked for Justice Thomas, and has the distinguished mark of having played professional baseball, so he is by far the least nerdy on the panel this morning. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Scott.
Well, thank you very much, Judge. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be part of this panel. Thank you very much for all of you for being here, and the Federal Society for having me. You know, at risk of talking about a landmark case is a lot of people already know a lot about the case. So I think I'll tell you a little bit more behind the scenes, behind the curtains, and I want to, in particular, tell you in brief the story of how the decision was made to ask the Supreme Court to overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Dobbs started in 2018 as a challenge to Mississippi's law generally prohibiting abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And the time point of that law, the 15-week mark, is important, of course, because of the way the Supreme Court defined the constitutional right to abortion in Roe and Casey. The court focused on the point of pregnancy known as viability, when unborn children can live outside the womb. Today, that's around 22 or 23 weeks of pregnancy, and the court essentially defined after Casey the right to mean that a state cannot put a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before viability. So you have a 15-week law, you have a rule that you cannot impose an undue burden, a substantial obstacle, before 22 or 23 weeks. So the case really tees up the question, can a pre-viability prohibition on elective abortions survive under Roe and Casey? The lower courts in the case said no, that's not possible. You can't have a more undue burden than a prohibition before viability, and that's kind of the end of the case. As long as Roe and Casey stand, this 15-week law has to fall. I came to the case quite late. I was not there in the district court. I was not there when the case was on appeal. I was not there in the summer of 2020 when the state of Mississippi asked the Supreme Court to take the case. And I showed up, I became the Solicitor General of Mississippi in early 2021. And at that time, the Supreme Court had been considering kind of week in, week out for some months, whether to take the case at all. So I kind of started the job. I, to be honest, I did not expect the court to take Dobbs. I had thought that the court was going to eventually deny review in the case, perhaps with a separate writing, maybe a dissent, suggesting there's a need to take a case of this sort or we should look closer at this issue. So it was very much to my surprise when, in May of 2021, the court took the case. And because I had no expectation the court was going to take the case, I had no strategy going in. I'd done no work on the case. I didn't, you know, really honestly know a lot about what the case was about at all. The first thing I did when I heard the court granted review was I printed out Roe versus Wade and went home and read it. These are maybe things you shouldn't say in public, but, you know, there they are. But obviously, I had to settle on a strategy pretty fast. I mean, things go fast, and attention was all of a sudden very much on Mississippi and what we were going to do. So the immediate question and the fundamental kind of fork in the road question in the case was, what should we argue? Should we argue for a full overrule that the court should completely get rid of 50 years of precedent and take out Roe and Casey, or should we argue for something more modest? So you just say, hey, you know, there's a way for this kind of a law to survive under Roe and Casey. I started talking to different friends, you know, as everybody knows, and the students, if they haven't learned it already, will learn, you know, lawyers have a lot of opinions, and they're very happy to share them with you. So I got a lot of calls, and I was very grateful for these calls. And, you know, there was some diversity opinion about the question of, you know, can a law like this coexist with Roe and Casey? Is there a way around that? You know, some people said, absolutely not. You can't have a more undue burden than a prohibition. Other people said, hey, look, you know, 15 weeks, That is plenty of time to get an abortion before viability. That's not an undue burden. So there was some diversity of opinion about that. But as for the strategy, as to what we should argue, as to what the court was going to be willing to do, there was a very strong consensus. And the strong consensus and the strong advice I got was the following. And I heard it time and again from people who had collectively argued dozens and dozens of Supreme Court cases. I had never argued in the Supreme Court before Dobbs. And the advice was, you know, Scott, like, do not argue to overrule Roe and Casey. It's never going to happen. That's not why the court took this case. If you make that argument, you could lose. You could lose badly. It could destroy your career. I actually had a conversation with a group of friends. Honestly, it felt kind of like an intervention. What they told me, they kind of like, you know, like, Scott, just like, this case is not about Roe and Casey. Like, that was the flat out message. So when you hear those kind of things and you're trying to gear up for your first Supreme Court case, like, those are pretty bracing. It's, you know, these are friends, you know, people who I was very grateful for their advice, people I have a lot of respect for. They really know what they're doing, brilliant lawyers. But I saw the case a little differently. You know, there were a few things that I thought weighed strongly in favor of a different approach than the one, than the consensus view. And one is, to me, very clearly the right argument is that the Constitution does not protect the right to abortion, period. Roe and Casey are egregiously wrong. You do not get more wrong as a matter of constitutional law than Roe and Casey. I thought that. So I thought that was the best argument. I mean, I would always prefer to say, you know, I win on a correct view of the Constitution than I win based on two very, very flawed decisions. And I thought that was the best argument for Mississippi. And Mississippi has for a long time tried to protect unborn children. It's had a very difficult time doing that under Roe and Casey. I mean, when Dobbs was granted, Casey was going on 30 years, Roe was going on 50 years. So that was the best thing for the state. And, you know, those are all good things, but there's something to this idea of, you know, like, what is realistic, what is possible, what would the court be willing to do? And I took that very seriously. I mean, not every at-bat can be a grand slam, and if you try to force it, you know, you could produce something that's very bad. So all those things about the legal arguments and everything, they weighed strongly, but the thing that was decisive for me, it's something that I've learned in my time in public service and doing hard cases, and it I think dovetails very nicely with something Judge Bumate said earlier today, and it's very simple. It's not a legal principle. It's just this. There's magic in boldness. And when you stand up for the right thing and you do it in the right way, impossible things can become possible. And, you know, I really respected what all of these, you know, brilliant lawyers, good friends were telling me, but, you know, they were intellectual arguments, and intellect cannot fully comprehend the power of truth boldly stated, of conviction, of standing on principle, of looking people in the eye and saying, do the right thing for the right reasons. So I believe. So for me, that was enough. I believe that if we did that, we did the argument in that way and did it, made the right argument for the right reasons, that we could win. We went for it. Our lead argument was for full overrule, and the case wasn't the same after that. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Cam.
Yeah, great to be here. This reminds me of the argument because I can't really see any of you, and I kind of did black out that whole time. But I should start with, I got to participate in this case, but all of the credit for the strategy, the thinking, the moves along the way, all the way up to the Supreme Court goes to our friend, the late Will Consovoy. He was the best lawyer I've ever met and ever will meet, and was a great legal strategist, and had this mapped out in his head before we ever filed it. And we filed this case in 2014. So I had just graduated law school when it was filed. And I sort of weaved in and out of the case as it went to trial, and I came back, I was in part of discovery, and then came back for the appeal. I was in and out doing clerkships, or what my dad likes to call, like, government internships that he never understood. But The case was filed in 2014, so remember Justice Kennedy was still on the Supreme Court. We didn't have the court that we do today or that we did when the case finally went up there. And some of the thinking behind how the case was structured is, I think, pretty obvious, but we were accused of hiding the ball, which people said this case is just a means to overrule the Grutter decision. It's like, count six of our complaint is overrule the Grutter decision. Like, that is very front and center of the strategy. You only sued Harvard because Harvard is a really important and is the model of that all this precedent is built upon. Yes, correct. That was the thinking. So if you had followed this area of the law, it really sort of started, maybe a false start, with a decision in the 70s called Bakke, where Justice Powell writes an opinion really just for himself, and that opinion actually attaches a portion of an amicus brief that was filed by Harvard in that case. And Justice Powell says, the Harvard plan, this is how you should do it. Race is one small tie-breaking factor among the last few applicants in the class. That's all the weight that it has. Anything more than that is not going to satisfy Title VI or the Constitution. Few years later, there's an article that comes out that says, you know, somebody should look at the history of how Harvard got to that holistic factor of a factor admissions policy. What they found is that, and pretty openly admitted, is back in the 1920s, Harvard made the shift away from test scores and grades towards a holistic subjective admissions policy because they were getting too many Jewish students admitted at Harvard. So the holistic admissions, the thing that Justice Powell endorsed and that Justice O'Connor's majority opinion in Grutter later latched onto, had a pretty gross history. And then you looked at Harvard and other Ivy League schools today, and it had been reported at the time already that the number of applications they were receiving from Asian Americans had gone way up. At the same time, the number of Asian Americans who were being admitted had plateaued at about 17 to 18%. Pretty consistently across the Ivy Leagues. So the same sort of problem that holistic admissions, so to speak, was trying to solve in the 20s, it looked like it was rearing its ugly head and discriminating again against another minority group. And then those of us who, in the conservative legal movement, long thought that Grutter itself was just based on a lie, that the universities were not using race to achieve the educational benefits of student body diversity. That is what they said because Justice Powell told them to say it. In reality, they were trying to construct a class that had a particular demographic balance, and they could report that number to the public and there's make themselves look better, make themselves feel better. It was about racial balancing all along. So finally, we did sue Harvard and looked under the hood for the first time since that amicus brief. We actually got into the facts of how Harvard was using race. The case took lots of twists and turns. It was not a smooth path. It took 8 years to get a decision from filing to the end of the Supreme Court path. Will Consovoy and Tom McCarthy left their law firm mostly to file this case, started their own law firm. They hired their first associate, Mike Connolly, wrote the complaint, got it on file. And then Harvard, we thought they would file a motion to dismiss, but they actually answered the complaint, which for those of you who are litigators know that means discovery is starting. To this three-person law firm, that was scary. And so they hired some friends of theirs, Patrick Strawbridge, now Judge Mike Park, Brian Weir, and some others. Eventually I came on, Jeff Harris as well. The firm grew to take on the case. Each lawyer at our firm worked significantly on this case. And then we got all the way to trial, and then we had another oh-no moment. A lot of us were considered ourselves appellate litigators. And so we hired Bartlett Beck, who I think is just probably the finest trial lawyers in the country. Adam Mortara, John Hughes, Krista Perry, they put together a great team, really tried the case tremendously. Took a lot of other twists and turns to get to where we were. We had a parallel case against the University of North Carolina. That case really got pretty far behind the Harvard case because of COVID and various circumstances, to where we had a cert petition on file in Harvard before we had a trial decision in UNC. Which kind of messed up the original vision that Will had of having a public school and a private school, having Title VI in the Constitution up there together. But we got lucky, and the court decided to CVSG the Harvard petition, so the Solicitor General had a chance to weigh in, which kicked that to a new term, which allowed UNC to be decided, which allowed us to file cert before judgment in UNC, which is what Will said all along we would do, because that's how Grutter and Gratz got up to the court. And so that worked out. And then, you know, really, I argued the Harvard case at the age of 34 because Will Consovoy unfortunately got sick. He and Tom could not do their original vision of one arguing one and the other arguing the other case. Will was sick. Justice Jackson got put on the bench, as well as three other new justices, and she was recused from the Harvard case. So now there was a need for two arguments and two lawyers. I got to be one of them. I'm very, very proud of being part of the team and getting to do the Supreme Court argument portion of it. A little worried that I may have peaked at the age of 34 and done the most important thing I'll ever do, but if any of you have landmark constitutional cases you would like argued, I am available.
Thank you for that pitch. Paul?
So it's a great pleasure to be here. It's a little bit ironic I'm following Cam because I feel like I'm a beneficiary of affirmative action here as the Scalia clerk on the panel. But you know, I think that's a permissible form of affirmative action. So I'm gonna talk about two cases that I've been very privileged to be involved in, the Bruin case and the Loper case. And I'll start with Bruin, and I'll start with a consideration of timing. And I think any time you're trying to kind of move the goalposts in constitutional law, either getting a case overturned or getting an earlier precedent essentially reaffirmed and revivified, I think the timing considerations are critically important. And you can go all the way back to Heller and think about the timing of Heller, because a little like the original complaint that Cam was talking about, where even when the case moves relatively quickly, you can have changes in the court's personnel between the time you file your initial complaint and the time you get to the Supreme Court. I mean, it's worth recognizing that the Heller case was filed while Justice O'Connor was still on the court and before Justice Alito was on the court. And if that case had gotten to the court a little bit quicker, we might be in a very different place in Second Amendment jurisprudence. But as with all of these things, there's a little bit of skill and there's a little bit of luck. So by the time Heller got up to the Supreme Court, we did have a court that was willing to really look at this as a matter of originalist first principles. Justice Scalia wrote an opinion that I think is one of the opinions that he was most justly proud of, as most directly reflecting a kind of his jurisprudence in the Heller case. Just a couple of years later, you got the McDonald case that reaffirmed that Heller wasn't just about the District of Columbia or the federal code. It was also applied to all of the states and was a fundamental constitutional right. I was able to play a small role in the McDonald case as an amicus, and you know, I sort of think back to law school, and I thought about all these debates about incorporation doctrine, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting stuff, but you know, I'll never get a chance to argue an incorporation case. But here it was, the Second Amendment incorporated against the states and federal governments. And at the time, I naively thought this was going to introduce kind of a revolution in the Second Amendment, because for 70 years, the Second Amendment was essentially kind of put on the back burner. The collective rights view of the Second Amendment prevailed in every circuit except the Fifth and the D.C. Circuit. And so logically, if you imagine a world where for 70 years state and local governments were passing gun laws, believing that they were essentially unrestricted by the Second Amendment, when the Supreme Court in McDonald made clear that the Second Amendment applied to every state and local government, one would have thought there would have been multiple laws passed in sort of the Miller era that would be invalidated by the lower courts. But as it turned out, nothing could be further from the truth. It was business as usual, and remarkably, the Supreme Court, even though the thrust of Heller and McDonald seemed to be being ignored by lower court judges, the Supreme Court seemed uninterested in getting back involved in the Second Amendment game. And you know, I say this based on personal experience, because in the years between McDonald and Bruin, I filed at least a dozen unsuccessful cert petitions. So it wasn't for lack of trying to get the issue back in front of the Supreme Court. And I will give a tip of the hat to the Thomas clerks on this panel to say, and it wasn't for lack of dissents from the denial of certiorari by Justice Thomas. But it took a long, long time and some additional modifications of the court's personnel, but eventually in the Bruin case, we finally got a case that the court was willing to revisit the Second Amendment. And there wasn't anything particularly special about the lower court decision in the Bruin case. In fact, the Second Amendment basically took it as a case that had been decided by virtue of an earlier Second Circuit case called Kochalski. So the lower court opinions were essentially non-events. So if you ask why did the court take the Bruin case, I think the true answer is because the court was ready to get back into the Second Amendment game after taking about a decade off. I'd like to think the cert petition had a little something to do with it. And in reviewing it for this panel, one of the things that I was particularly sort of proud of in retrospect was the reply brief. And one of the things we did is we had a circuit split that we could point to, but we also pointed out that there was kind of, even beyond the circuit split, there was a broader split in the country. Because what you had is, you know, laws that restricted the right to carry were prevalent on the coasts, but in most of the circuits that would have probably been the places you really wanted to litigate the right to carry issue, the laws actually were great. And the laws gave you either a right to carry or constitutional carry. So there was this weird dynamic where, in addition to a little bit of a circuit split, there were vast parts of the country where citizens could have their Second Amendment right to carry outside the home. And then there were these kind of blue corridors on each coast where the circuits had largely upheld serious restrictions on the right to carry. So I think kind of if there was some sort of, you know, reasonably clever strategy at the cert stage, I think it was really to shift the emphasis from just the circuit split to essentially a nation divided. And in the context of a fundamental right that's supposed to apply equally from coast to coast, it really doesn't make any sense to have sort of a map where in vast swaths of the country you can exercise your constitutional rights, but on the coasts you can't. So the court did take the case, and the oral argument was certainly eventful, and it was probably some of the most interesting questions were in discussing kind of the history and tradition test from Heller. What was the right history and tradition? What time period mattered most? Was it the original framing? Was it the sort of framing of the 14th Amendment? And some of those issues were kicked around in the argument. I did leave the argument feeling pretty good, and I will say one thing about this, which is obviously for good and sufficient reasons, Justice Thomas gets a great deal of credit for writing the wonderful opinion that he wrote in the Bruin decision that really did revive the Second Amendment and really did sort of deliver on the promise of the Heller case. But I think one justice who gets less credit than he deserves for the terrific result in the Bruin case is the Chief Justice. Because not only was the Chief Justice in the majority, but the Chief Justice made a conscious decision to assign the Bruin opinion to Justice Thomas. And the chief had to know the kind of opinion he was going to get if you assign the opinion to Justice Thomas. And that would be clear enough if you just met Justice Thomas. But remember, there's like a decade worth of dissents from denial of certiorari written by Justice Thomas in this area that laid out Justice Thomas's vision of the Second Amendment. And so, you know, I think kudos to the chief for assigning this case to Justice Thomas, and I think we got the wonderful opinion that we did as a result of that. So let me shift gears and talk a little bit about the Loper case. Here too, I think timing is very important. Most of you may have a sense that when the Chevron doctrine originally sort of entered the law, it was something that most conservatives cheered. Now, they had a very specific contextual reason to cheer, and that was what the D.C. Circuit looked like in the mid-80s. and particularly Judge Bazelon, Judge Skelly Wright, and those judges on the D.C. Circuit were really making life difficult for some of the deregulatory impulses of the Reagan administration. And so, in a sense, at the time of Chevron, I think it was largely applauded by most conservatives. And I think efforts to get Chevron overruled 10 years in, 20 years in, probably would have been wildly unsuccessful. I think the flaws of Chevron really started to show the longer and longer that it was on the books. And my own view is that, you know, the fundamental difference in thinking about Chevron, especially among conservatives, is that the original decision in Chevron was thought of as a choice between the executive branch and the judiciary as to which one was better positioned to interpret ambiguous statutes. And there's some logic to the sense that if we're down to the executive branch and the judiciary, at least the executive branch is more politically accountable than the life-tenured judiciary, so maybe it makes sense in cases of true ambiguity to give some deference to the executive branch. And I think over time, what became clear is that ignored the effect on the third branch. And the effects of Chevron over time on Congress and the ease with which Congress could essentially decline to engage on difficult and important issues because at any one time, roughly half the senators or half the representatives had friends in the executive branch. During a Democratic administration, all the Democrats had friends in the executive branch and vice versa when the Republicans were in the executive branch. A lot of the people in the executive branch were former congressional staffers. So why tackle a difficult and controversial issue and maybe, you know, compromise with the other side when you can call up your friends in the executive branch and get an executive order or rulemaking that essentially gets you everything you want? And over time, I think the debilitating effect on Congress became more and more clear. Other defects with Chevron and its application in the real world, the fact that nobody really agreed on what ambiguity meant. Judge Kethledge famously said that he'd never actually gotten to step two of Chevron, which is, you know, kudos to Judge Kethledge. But there are other judges in other circuits where all the action was on step two and there was deference to everything. So the timing was right to have the court revisit Chevron. And here, too, you know, I'd taken a crack at Chevron in an earlier petition or two. But I was really delighted to get a call one day from my friends. And it was an invitation to get involved in this case, Loper-Bright, which I hadn't previously been involved in. And it was an invitation that I accepted as soon as I heard about the facts of this case. Because the facts of the case were what, in my view, gave us a chance to make this the vehicle to get the Supreme Court to take another look at Chevron. And what I particularly liked about the facts of the case, and most of you are familiar, this is a case where the National Marine Fisheries Service decided in its wisdom that when it didn't have enough monitors to enforce all of the various regulations that it imposes on the fishing industry, that the right solution was to not to have fewer regulations, but was to make the fishing industry essentially pay for additional monitors. So the small fishing vessels not only had the indignity of giving up one of the scarce seats on their boat for a monitor who couldn't do any fishing but would just check and make sure all these regulations are being enforced, but not only did they have to give way for that officer, but they had to pay their salary. And that to me seemed a really egregious case for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, one of the few arguments you could make in favor of Chevron was agency expertise. So maybe if you're talking about whether some really complicated 13-syllable compound is a hazardous waste, like maybe there's a role for some agency expertise. But how much agency expertise does it take to say that when we've run out of money, we will impose what is effectively a tax on the regulated to pay for additional monitoring of our voluminous regulation? That doesn't take any expertise at all. That's just sort of bad big government in action. So the facts really sort of spoke to me. And then I did, one of my favorite lines from the cert petition was something to the effect of, you know, under the Third Amendment, you know, not to quarter soldiers in your home. Like, even the British didn't think that the colonialists had to pay the redcoats' salary directly. And that was really, you know, having helped revive the Second Amendment, that was part of my, you know, nascent effort to revive the Third Amendment. So then I'll try to wind up. But then, you know, in the cert petition, we presented an issue that was very specific to the statute at issue, and then offered the second question presented: should the court substantially cut back or overrule on Chevron? And to my great surprise, after multiple relists, the court granted cert limited to question two. So it was clear when we went into the oral argument that the court was really going to be swinging for the fences in this case. And I'll finish by saying here, I think the Chief Justice had another great decision in terms of who to assign the opinion to. He assigned it to himself. And I think, you know, on these administrative law questions and these questions of the separation of powers, I mean, the Chief really does feel very deeply about these issues. In the same session as Loper Bright, he also wrote the Jakarzy case, where he also laid down a great landmark for the separation of powers. And walking out of the argument, I think the big question was, is the Supreme Court going to go all the way and overrule Chevron, or is it going to so-called Kaiserize Chevron and say, well, it doesn't apply many places, but we're going to limit its applications? And I will just close by saying my three favorite words in a Supreme Court opinion of late are, Chevron is overruled.
Thank you. Matt?
Thank you, Judge. Thrilled to be up here with this great group of CT clerks and Paul. Less thrilled about having to go after Paul's very insightful comments. So as you all know, the Scrimeti case involved a challenge to Tennessee's law that protected kids from risky, unproven gender transition interventions. The ACLU and the Biden administration brought suit seeking to enjoin the law, and the case made its way to the Supreme Court, and that's actually where I first got involved. The case was handled below by Cam Norris, Adam Mortara, and some folks on our team, but Cam assured me that even I couldn't lose this case, so I tapped in. At that point. So ultimately, we did get the win. The Supreme Court upheld the law under the Equal Protection Clause, and I think it's important how the court did so. So the court's decision turned largely on its classification analysis. It tracked very closely with the Godoldig decision and ultimately held that Tennessee's law only imposed age and medical use-based classifications. It did not classify on the basis of sex and transgender status. And given that the classifications were based off of primarily medical use, the court said that rational basis review applies, and it declined to second guess the decision by the Tennessee legislatures, noting that states have wide discretion when it comes to areas of medical and scientific uncertainty. And so I kind of want to highlight two high-level takeaways from the court's decision and from this case. And first, I think that the arc of this case kind of encapsulates the dangers of turning over and surrendering the Constitution to what Justice Thomas referred to as the expert class. So a few years ago when these cases started, states were being sued over these laws throughout the country. They were almost uniformly losing in these cases, and invariably the lower court decisions would point to the so-called medical guidelines from WPATH and other supposed expert health organizations. Indeed, when the United States sought cert, it put in its cert petition that overwhelming evidence supports these interventions and that the overwhelming consensus of the medical community was that this was the proper medical standard of care. But that narrative disintegrated at almost the same time that our case reached the court. And that happened for a couple of reasons. One, the activists made the horrible decision of going after the great state of Alabama. Alabama had its own parallel litigation, and during discovery, General LaCour, now Judge LaCour, and General Marshall uncovered what were, I think, for most people, kind of devastating emails. These were supposed to be medical guidelines, and instead, the emails showed a process that was rife with political considerations, with policy considerations. And I just want to read one of the emails that was discovered in the Alabama litigation. And this is a quote. "Our concerns, echoed by the social justice lawyers we spoke with, is that evidence-based review of these interventions reveals little or no evidence and puts us in an untenable position in terms of affecting policy or winning lawsuits." So these were the experts that the federal courts were deferring to. At about the same time, the United Kingdom published an independent review by Dr. Hilary Cass. And that independent review found, quote, "remarkably weak evidence in support of these gender transition interventions in kids." And so that led some of the countries that had pioneered these interventions, Sweden, Finland, and the UK, not exactly conservative meccas, to pull back and restrict the use of these interventions in kids. And ultimately, at oral argument, the ACLU's attorney was forced to admit that there is no evidence in the studies that these treatments reduce completed suicide. So that was a main talking point. That was kind of a driving force that we saw below, and it kind of unraveled as our case reached the Supreme Court. And I do think that these cases kind of laid bare the dangers of simply deferring to the so-called experts when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. Whether it's abortion, whether it's COVID, whether it's gender transition, these experts are taking policy positions to move forward their policy preferences, and I don't think the court should be embracing that. The second kind of meta point that I want to make about the court's decision is I thought it was a pretty clear signal from the Roberts Court that the judiciary needs to leave the political battles where they belong, which is in the political process and the democratic process. For decades, advocacy organizations have asked the federal judiciary, under the guise of constitutional interpretation, to confer rights that they were unable to gain support of in the democratic process. And the court of the old days was largely granting them those rights under the guise of constitutional interpretation. But here, the court just said no. It refused to constitutionalize one side's view of a disputed medical question. And by doing so, I think it reaffirmed that politically accountable lawmakers and the democratic process is where this belongs, much like the court did in the Dobbs decision when it returned the issue of abortion to the states. And I do think that refusal to create new constitutional rights and to adhere to the original meaning of the Constitution is what's driving a lot of the unfounded attacks on the court right now. It's always amazing to me how they can characterize the refusal to create a new right as somehow justifying the notion that there is a runaway Supreme Court. But I think that the court knows that long-term adhering to the strictures of the Constitution, like it did in the Scrimeti case, like it's been consistently doing as of late, is what maintains the court's legitimacy. The court refused to get caught up in the political winds of the moment and adhered to the original meaning of the Constitution, and I hope that trend continues.
Well, thank you all for the opening remarks. Paul and Cam, you talked about the historical trajectory of how you achieved the final rulings at the Supreme Court. Scott, I know you said you inherited the case after you became SG. Could you talk about how there had been groundwork laid, certainly with trying to overrule Roe v. Wade, before you took on the case?
Sure. I mean, especially in a case, as everyone knows, I mean, the issue of abortion is obviously unique in American life, and people's convictions and feelings about Roe and about Casey, I mean, again, they go back decades, and Dobbs kind of was a late entry in a long process of trying to make progress on beating back or potentially getting rid of Roe and Casey. There were a lot of different pieces. Some were advocacy pieces. Some were kind of efforts at things that didn't play out, maybe constitutional amendments. What was happening quite a bit, you know, I actually remember being a law clerk at the time. There were efforts to try to get more involved in imposing health regulations on abortion procedures. And I think the challenge that a lot of those laws in cases like Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt ended up facing was, I mean, the arguments were made under Roe and Casey, so they were just very, very hard to win. I mean, if you're arguing under those things, you're in a challenging spot. What ended up happening a little bit more in the lead up to Dobbs was states started enacting laws similar to this 15-week law. I believe some of them were kind of 18-week laws to see if, you know, hey, can we test this viability line? How firm is it? How central is it to Roe and Casey? None of those really took off in the sense of getting, you know, granted for review in the Supreme Court. So this 15-week law came about. A lot of thought was given to it. A lot of care was given to it by some very smart and careful lawyers and getting the legislation really well done. And I think that was quite helpful because one big part, Paul mentioned this a little when he was talking about Loper-Bright, is, you know, the story matters a lot in these cases. And if a legislature or, you know, a group that wants some movement in the law does not establish and tell the story for itself, like, that story will be told some way or another. So one very nice thing done in Dobbs itself was the legislature laid out a set of findings about unborn life, about abortion's risks to women, about the effects of abortions on doctors who end up performing them. And it made it so the story of the case kind of wrote itself. I mean, other things I just add before kind of closing on the point are a lot had changed since Roe and Casey, of course, obviously, and, you know, as Justice Alito's ultimate opinion made clear, a lot of things that were kind of asserted to be true in Roe and then in Casey just were not defensible about history, about science, about the effects of abortion, about unborn life, about all those things. And ultimately, through a lot of efforts of a lot of other people, before, again, I ever got involved in the case, I mean, the truth was kind of undeniable, which I think is ultimately why, I mean, most of the case ended up being about not as what is the right answer to this constitutional question, but I mean, most of what we talked about was stare decisis. I mean, that was most of our brief. So those are a few things that come up in a case like this.
Okay, thank you. So we've talked about originalism now at the court, and certainly the court looks to things like history and tradition, particularly in Bruin. But we also see the justices disagreeing about how to do that and what matters. For example, Rahimi, we saw a lot of separate writings on different justices' views, Vidal in the First Amendment context. Does anyone want to comment on maybe trends we're going to see in the next few years of the Roberts Court on these originalist disagreements?
Well, I won't leave you hanging. I won't leave you hanging.
Thank you.
I think that, obviously you're seeing this in the Second Amendment context. You see it in other contexts where the court has emphasized the importance of history and tradition. And I guess what I would say is, I mean, to the extent that the justices or lower court judges are engaging on that issue and disagreeing, I mean, what a wonderful world we're living in when that's the terrain that judges and justices are deciding some of these questions and taking it seriously. And, you know, as I guess sort of the senior statesman of this panel, I can maybe appreciate just how different that is from when, you know, I first started practicing before the court. And so, you know, to the extent that you know, not everybody sort of, you know, does history the way that, you know, I would sort of prefer them to do, or to the extent that there are kind of, you know, debates about whether the right period of framing is, you know, the English Bill of Rights, the United States Bill of Rights, or the 14th Amendment. I mean, you know, that is such a radical improvement from the way things sort of used to be that, you know, that I sort of, you know, kind of celebrate where we are. You know, where we go from here I think is, you know, probably down to a lot of the people in this room. But there are some real opportunities to kind of, you know, reinforce the primacy of history and tradition. I think, you know, critics of the history and tradition and originalism more broadly are, you know, talk about law office history and the imprecision of the use of history. And I think in some respects that's a challenge that we need to rise to, because on some of these issues, there isn't much history. You know, on some of these issues, there's just, you know, only so much you can squeeze out of the statute of, you know, Northampton or whatever. But that's okay. And, you know, the lack of history ought to create room for the political branches to do things, not for courts to make stuff up. And so I think, you know, continuing to engage in this debate about both the primacy of history, but also the limits of history, and good uses of history and good history versus bad history. I mean, I think that's going to be an important process in sort of the decade to come and sort of the next, you know, next segment of the Roberts Court. But I do think sort of the challenge to, you know, to those of us that sort of believe that that is actually the right way to interpret the Constitution is to really continue to fight for the vibrancy of that and, you know, to get back and put in a word for Justice Scalia. I mean, you know, part of, you know, why he believed in both originalism, original public meaning, and the use of history and tradition is because he did think ultimately there were answers there that would constrain judges and keep them in the proper judicial role. And I think, you know, keeping that in mind as we have these debates about the proper use of history, I think is critical.
Looking for next horizons, what will the emergency docket, how will that impact the cases that the court takes and how they frame them and analyze them? Do you think that will continue to have such a prominent role in the next few years?
Yeah, happy to weigh in there. So I worry a little bit that the emergency docket takes up a lot of the oxygen and a lot of the court's attention. And I know that that's a concern probably many share. It's, you know, I don't want to put the, a lot of people put the blame on the Supreme Court. You could say, like, why are there so many nationwide injunctions in the first place that they need emergency action? I think the blame could be on the district courts that were overreaching. But those do take a lot of time and resources and attention from the court, and they often result in opinions that I don't think are gonna really be here for the long term. They're short, they're less explained, their precedential value is debated. I really wish we have certainly the greatest Supreme Court in my lifetime. I really wish this court would take more on the merits docket. And I'm hoping that the reason why the merits docket is not, it keeps declining every single year. I hope that's not because they can spend more time on the emergency docket.
The small merits docket, how does that impact each of your decisions on granting cert or how you frame questions to take up by the court, given how few they do?
Well, it's hard to get cert granted. I'm with Kim. I'm hopeful that if lower courts are faithfully applying CASA, that there will be less statewide and universal injunctions that require us to go up there in an emergency posture. We don't typically love to have to file these emergency stays, but sometimes when our laws have been enjoined statewide, which is still continuing to happen even post-CASA, we're forced to do so. I do think the court is also hearing the criticisms. I think they're unwarranted. But back when I was clerking, which was just 2019, they weren't taking stays and putting them on the oral argument calendar. They weren't hearing them more like they hear merits cases. But I think they've been doing that more and more and responding to the criticisms of the court and of the emergency docket, which, again, I don't think are, you know, super warranted. My last point on the emergency docket is I know there's been some recent call for more kind of reasoned decisions from the Supreme Court, and I may have a contrarian view on this, but I don't think that's actually going to be super helpful because they're done so quickly, as Cam said, and because the criticisms are not coming from the lower court. The lower courts are the legal scholars. The criticisms are coming from the mainstream media that don't like the outcome that they're reaching on whatever the stay application is. So even if they write out their reasoning more, the criticism I don't think is going to go away. I think they're still not going to like the policy outcomes, and you're going to have the same type of criticism of the emergency docket.
Please.
Those points are all well stated. You know, I'll offer another observation on the emergency docket. I clerked on the court in 2015 to 2016, and I was talking to a co-clerk yesterday, and neither of us could remember the United States Solicitor General filing an emergency application that entire term. And we are certainly the last term that can say that. I mean, you always have the emergencies associated with executions, inherently important and by their nature often end up last minute. But we just had what felt like a handful of those. And again, no later term of clerks could say that because it's so prominent. An observation I might offer is that around the time I clerked, it felt like during the Obama administration, it's the last time I recall kind of a lot of, or you know, a meaningful amount of substantial, large, comprehensive legislation happening. You know, we're 30 years from EDPA. It's been a while since we had a big overhaul of the immigration laws. You know, Dodd-Frank, the Affordable Care Act are now some years behind. So most of the policymaking takes place in the executive branch by executive order or by administrative action. And you know, if those things are just put completely on pause, there's going to be an overwhelming inclination and desire for the executive branch to try to get that corrected as quickly as possible. Because I mean, the other possibility is just wait a year and a half, 2 years, 2.5 years, most of a presidential term to get those things corrected. So I think it's a little bit perhaps a function of where much of the policymaking is taking place, and perhaps the inability to get kind of larger policy measures through Congress the way that has happened in perhaps past decades.
Yeah, if I could just, you know, I mean, I think Scott's right about that last point. Now, you know, I think the framers had a vision for where the policymaking should take place, and they probably thought it was the Article I branch. So, I mean, I do think that, the low merits docket may be a little bit of a product of kind of where we are on the separation of powers and the fact that Congress kind of hasn't passed a lot of landmark legislation in recent years, because I do think part of the court's merits docket is like about a 10-year lagged effect of major legislation. I mean, when I was in the SG's office, like every term the court had one or two Americans with Disabilities Act cases, because about 10 years earlier, that was a big statute. It was also a statute that had some ability for private parties to enforce it, which is a formula for creating circuit splits and all that kind of stuff. So that is part of the puzzle. I do think part of the puzzle is the court, I don't know if it was because of COVID or whatever it was, but the court has sort of gotten used to the idea that like 60 merits cases is a good round number. And that seems kind of crazy to me from a historical perspective. I mean, when I was clerking, it was a nice round number of 100. Candidly, nobody was that overworked. So, I do think that, the fewer cases does have some negative effects for the court itself, because, every year there's going to be like somewhere between 5 and 10 kind of big hot button, more sort of social issue cases. And, if that's like 16% of the court's docket is, social issues where the court's closely divided, there's going to be a perspective of the court that inevitably comes from that. Whereas if there are more and more cases that the court decides, the hot button issues are a smaller percentage, and there are more cases where the court decides cases unanimously or nearly unanimously, I think that gives rise to sort of a different image of the court in the public mind, and probably one that works better for the court. So, I do think, and obviously I have my reasons to think this, but I think the court should be taking more cases on the merits. And I'll just make one last pitch here. Scott and Matt have the inestimable advantage of at least being able to file cert petitions on behalf of a state. And, state on top petitions do get a pretty close look up at the court. Cam and I are in the less fortunate position of filing cert petitions for plucky non-institutional litigants. And, I think one of the things that really increases the chances of the court taking one of our cases is if there is substantial amicus support. So, I would urge folks, when there are issues that we think we'd love to get in front of this court while we have this court, trying to sort of band together a little bit and file amicus briefs to get these issues so these cases don't get sort of lost in the shuffle, I think is something that really helps a lot.
I think a Paul Clement petition gets plenty of attention, to be clear.
Several of you have touched on post-CASA, right? We have maybe a decline in seeing nationwide injunctions. Does that mean it's finally ripe for the court to decide the vacatur question, which is, frankly, where most of the emergency applications arise out of anyways, given that it's agency rules, that sort of thing? Do we expect that the court will decide either what 706 means or whether vacatur is even a constitutional remedy that the courts possess under the APA?
I think they're going to decide it, because I think the Trump administration is pushing it. I don't think they have the votes, though, to depart from the current position. And so I think it's certainly a strategic decision to continue pushing that view. I don't see where you get the fifth vote, and I'm not sure I understand the strategy, because instead of getting nationwide vacatur, you're having to go back through the notice and comment process on a series of regulations that you disagree with from a policy perspective. But I think they pushed it en banc at the fifth, and so I suspect it'll be at the court within a year or two.
Obviously, we've seen a lot of action on executive power, other than perhaps Humphrey's executor and President's power over tariffs. Any other executive power precedents or areas we should expect to see the court rule on?
I'll offer one, at least from the perspective of state. I guess a lot of the executive power issues you see now is, can the executive do this? And I'll offer one that may be more along the lines of, can only the executive do this? And that would be immigration. In Arizona versus United States, the Supreme Court issued a decision that has, as a practical matter, sharply limited states' ability to address illegal immigration. It's been read to sometimes completely bar states from kind of doing anything in entire areas. I think given the importance of that topic, I mean, obviously it's been practically hugely important in both of President Trump's administrations, but also when you don't have an executive that is eager to enforce the immigration laws, it's one of these odd areas where they can just go largely unenforced to a very significant extent, and if states are completely powerless, then the policy consequences are essentially just unavoidably bad. So I think that might be a possible topic. Justice Scalia issued a very strong dissent that raised, again, kind of sovereignty themes, the state's inherent power to address those kinds of issues, a good historical analysis of those issues. It's not as hot a topic during this kind of administration, but I think it could become hot again in a coming administration.
Yeah, I've got a shameless plug answer to this. In our case, in the Harvard case, there was a footnote, I think it's footnote 4 of the opinion, that was kind of interesting. The Chief Justice said, we're not deciding the constitutionality of race-based admissions at our U.S. military academies. To the Trump administration's great credit, and to the credit of our client, Edward Bloom, and Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA immediately almost turned around and sued the Naval Academy in West Point to test that footnote. And pleased to report, as a matter of sort of executive power, the military has entered settlements with SFFA, and they are not using race in admissions at any of the U.S. military academies going forward.
So I'll just offer a couple of bonus thoughts on this. I mean, I think questions about appropriations and the extent to which the executive branch has to expend appropriated funds and the extent to which kind of the power of the purse interacts with the power of the executive to take care that the law is faithfully executed, I think those issues will get up in front of the court. I mean, they're obviously going to be issues in a variety of sort of dynamics where the sort of limits on executive orders and what can be accomplished through an executive order as opposed to what requires legislation, I think those issues are going to get in front of the court in probably about like a dozen different flavors. So it's not like one doctrine that will be at stake in those cases, the way Humphrey's executor is going to be at stake at the slaughter case. But I think that sort of line about how much policymaking can be done in the executive branch is something that will get up there. And then it's a little off topic, I suppose, but the other issue I think is going to be a really interesting one to watch is a question of the power of the judiciary. And I think like one of the more interesting and important cases of the last couple of decades that kind of went largely unnoticed for about two decades until the CASA decision really put a spotlight on it. But the Grupo Mexicano case and the notion that the equitable powers of the federal courts are really limited to what was available in equity in 1789, because all of the equitable powers go back to the Judiciary Act of 1789. Like, that's a really big deal. And it, you know, in sort of a way like, you know, I was talking about with Heller, where if that's right, then there ought to be a lot of things that change. And the court said that in Grupo Mexicano, and not much changed. And I think by kind of refocusing on that, there really are some interesting opportunities that could find their way all the way to the Supreme Court. And just to pick, you know, one example, I mean, for those of you that do a little bit of kind of tort litigating and the like, mass torts, you know, one of the kind of classic ways for the plaintiff's bar to get around the limits on B3 class actions is to have a B2 class action that involves medical monitoring. And the idea that, like, you know, medical monitoring is an equitable remedy and therefore it's a B2 class, so you don't need opt-out and all of those kind of things. Well, you know, if you can show me a 1789 Chancery Court decision that ordered medical monitoring, I will be highly surprised. So there are aspects, you know, of kind of equitable practice today that are kind of accepted as very commonplace that I think are really hard to square with Grupo Mexicano. So I think that may be another area where of kind of new interest in the court.
Yeah, certainly, right? And the court has the one case that asks about equitable powers over reinstating and removal from public office. So I think it's an interesting area to watch. Anything else before we open up for questions from the audience that panelists would like to make about the future of the Roberts Court? Any other cert cases, Cam, you want us to consider?
Yeah, all of mine.
Oh. Okay, I don't know who has the microphone, but we wanted to save the last 15 minutes for any questions from the audience. Who is the point person with the microphone from?
Well, my name is Mark Holmes from U.S. Tax Credit. This has nothing to do with tax, fortunately. But I'm wondering if any of the panelists are seeing anything bubble up that would change or challenge on originalist grounds the constitutional criminal procedure cases of the 60s or the voting and redistricting cases of the 1960s, where the Supreme Court evidently went way, way, way beyond any original meaning of the Constitution or the 14th Amendment.
Anyone want to take that?
I was thinking Cam might want to talk about
redistricting.
But I'm happy to take a crack if you don't want to.
They've got a huge case in front of them right now on redistricting. I think we're all eagerly awaiting the decision in Calais. That's been re-argued. Could be monumental change in how that field works. In terms of criminal procedure, I just personally find interesting and sort of an old thing that the conservative justices used to attack, which was the exclusionary rule. I think if you're an originalist, there's not much to say for the exclusionary rule as a remedy, and there's not much to say especially about the federal courts somehow applying that to the states in a binding manner. I think this is one of those areas where and there's a lot of death penalty jurisprudence where this will apply too, and you see it getting tested right now. State legislatures will have to tee these issues up by crafting new legislation that tries to challenge the precedent in question and get that litigated that way. I think that'll be an interesting avenue. I think I read just yesterday that there are some states that are trying this with respect to the death penalty for those who sexually assault children, and have put that back on the table to bring those cases up to the court.
I think Florida might be one of those. I read that.
Tennessee does too.
Yes, sir?
Hi, Pepper Crutcher. I chair the Labor and Employment Practice Group. Was the Jarkissi set of opinions the high watermark of failed efforts to overturn Atlas Roofing, or is there a case out there, or could there be a case that might get 5 votes for that purpose?
Well, so I don't think that Jarkissi is the high watermark, and I think that, you know, in a sense, I hope that there will be follow-on cases that that sort of extend it and make clear that there's nothing about sort of the doctrine that is limited to the SEC. You know, our earlier keynote speaker, Judge Bumate, wrote a wonderful dissent in a Ninth Circuit case, kind of pointing out how many of the remedies that the NLRB has discovered lurking within its statute are inconsistent with the Seventh Amendment and with the thrust of Jarkissi, and we're in the process of asking the court to sort of vindicate Judge Bumate's view on that. Hopefully there will be some opportunities to kind of continue in that direction. And I would say more broadly, I mean, one of the things I loved about the Jarkissi opinion was the fact that it sort of harkened back to the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, in sort of this 250th year, I think there's a lot to be said for kind of rereading that amazing document. And, you know, my recollection of it is there's actually two places in the grievances that the framers had where they talked about the king cutting back on the right to jury trials. So I think that's another area where we may see some additional and some positive movement in the next few years of the Roberts Court.
Yes, sir.
Devin Watkins. My question is, how far do you think the court is going to go to limit or overturn Humphrey's executor? Do you think it's going to get completely overturned? Do you think it's going to be limited only to the executive branch and not the Federal Reserve? That will they continue to be protected? Or how far do you see the court going?
It's hard to predict, I think, the outcome of any case. I mean, I think most of Humphrey's executor was, I thought, already undermined by seal of law. To the extent that there was anything of Humphrey's executor left from that, I think it was a mere sliver, because the court there largely kind of undercut all of the reasoning of Humphrey's executor, which is why I'm not necessarily surprised to see what we've been seeing on the emergency docket with respect to removals. Nor do I agree with the influencer professors who say that Humphreys was overruled on the emergency docket. I think they did it in CELA in all but name. They just don't like to come out and say what they're doing.
Okay, other side.
Morning, David Axelman from Tallahassee. My question is primarily for Mr. Rice on this Scrimeti case and your discussion about reliance on the expert classes. Obviously, the WPATH documents you mentioned were a bombshell, but we know that the Academy of Pediatrics, other organizations have kind of issued pronouncements of a similar nature, and it turns out there's little or no involvement by the membership of those organizations. And yet, it seems that these courts, like the court in Scrimeti and other trial courts, have kind of taken for granted that these organizations actually do speak for their membership and have the support of their membership. So my question for you is, do you think going forward courts ought to be more skeptical, given what we've just seen with the gender-affirming care cases, about whether these expert organization pronouncements really do represent the views of their membership? Relatedly, do you think that's fair game in litigation? These organizations have invoked associational freedom with some success to prevent discovery into how they make their decisions, and yet, when courts are just deferring to this, they're kind of being allowed to set public policy without anybody seeing how they've made their decisions. So do you think that aspect of Scrimeti maybe will have some influence going forward?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, And I certainly hope that everyone realizes that some of these pronouncements are not reflective of the actual members of these bodies, rather that there's a small group of leadership putting out certain positions. I mean, I hope that most people in the ABA don't think that the Equal Rights Amendment was ratified. In terms of these organizations joining suits, I mean, I think that Eddie and the folks in Alabama gave us a model that if they want to be involved in these lawsuits and they want to be a party to these lawsuits, then you should go after all of their documents. And I suspect that you're going to find with a lot of these groups similar documents to what Alabama found when it peeked under the hood in WPATH.
If I could add a little to that, one observation, just seeing kind of Matt and others litigate these cases is, and we've mentioned amicus briefs, there have been a good number of amicus briefs over the last few years in the cases on Scrimeti, on the sorts of laws at issue in Scrimeti that explain that a lot of these, again, the expert class, these groups that are opining are not honest brokers, are not, and really just boil down to be advocacy organizations. I mean, this was a similar issue that came up in the abortion space a lot when you would have these groups portraying themselves as kind of the objective, this is the medical consensus. And these would be groups that were plaintiffs in very, very prominent, contentious abortion cases. And I think calling it out, being clear about what is going on here is important, and not accepting that there's a consensus or that there is an expert view or that the expert view is one based on truth or science is very important, and it's been done very well both by litigating parties and states, but also by very, very skilled amici.
Yes.
Good morning. Eric Lansing with the Office of the Attorney General of Virginia. This question is for anyone, but I have a feeling it will probably be especially red meat for Mr. Clement. This question is about a type of deference that I've heard surprisingly little of in administrative law. So little of that I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I think it's our deference, A-U-E-R, our deference. And I'm wondering what you all might think about the future of that type of deference. Our deference is essentially where the judiciary will defer to an administrative agency on the interpretation, not of statutes, but of its own regulations.
Well, I can't resist red meat. Never have been able to. Our deference or Seminole Rock deference, just so it's maybe easier to pronounce, but they're sort of synonymous. That is exactly what the Supreme Court sort of blinked on a little bit in Kaiser, and they managed to sort of say, well, that kind of deference is limited to sort of very kind of narrow circumstances. And, I guess I do think that probably, Loper, the combination of getting rid of Chevron deference and then, the Kaiser opinion largely limiting our deference is probably maybe enough to sort of take care of the problem. I mean, the court may eventually kind of have a cleanup case, and if there might be a case out there where it really sort of tees up the issue directly. But this, kind of could be one of those situations where, having done sort of half the job in Kaiser and then taking a lot of the pressure off of it, because, what would happen in the era of sort of Seminole Rock plus Chevron is you'd have an ambiguous statute that would then be extended by an ambiguous regulation that would then be extended by an interpretation of the ambiguous regulation. And if you sort of cut out the first part of this, I think in most of the cases, the question at the end of the day is just going to be, what does the statute mean? And the agency doesn't have quite as much scope to sort of get anywhere by promulgating an ambiguous regulation and then interpreting it or disambiguating it in litigation or something. So, it's still out there. Obviously, the other sort of big, issue that's out there is, what does Skidmore respect mean? And does Skidmore respect sort of introduce a lot of the same problems? It depends a little bit on how that's applied. And then there are also issues about sort of, what are the limits? We no longer have deference in this sort of implied delegation fiction of Chevron, But there's still plenty of statutes that, you know, I think most courts would interpret as expressly delegating a fair amount of discretion to the agency. And some of those statutes end up raising some of the same kind of accountability problems that you had under the Chevron regime. So suffice it to say, there are plenty of interesting issues out there and not quite full employment, but I think there are plenty of good issues out there in the administrative law space.
Yes, sir.
Sorry. Isaiah McKinney. So my question is to the whole panel, but especially to Mr. Norris, regarding the exclusionary rule. And I think, as the most originalists would agree, the exclusionary rule is just is atextual. But if you get rid of the exclusionary rule, in the climate we live in with sovereign immunity and qualified immunity having such strong teeth as they do, how likely is it that litigants are actually going to be able to vindicate their rights under like the Fourth and Fifth Amendments if we remove the exclusionary rule? Like, my fear would be that that would create, like, remove a lot of the checks on law enforcement from violating the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, unless we do something with qualified immunity, et cetera. So do you think the court would actually get rid of the exclusionary rule and simultaneously do something with qualified immunity? Or is there going to be some other avenue for litigants to hold law enforcement accountable?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I think a state legislature, in most instances, is going to have to tee this question up. And I think what would be wise is to, if you're going to replace the exclusionary rule, replace it with something that still has some protections for like instances of truly bad faith action from the police. Not something I say very often, but I think Canada does this pretty well. My understanding of the law in most other countries is that the exclusionary rule is not a penalty for illegal searches or seizures, which happens to benefit those who are actually guilty of crime, just another weird thing about it.
Right.
But that in cases of egregious police misconduct, it can be available as a penalty because you don't want the police to have an incentive to ignore constitutional rights, you know, on purpose. But in a lot of cases, I mean, the last thing the Supreme Court wrote about this, and I believe an opinion from Justice Scalia about the professionalization of the police and how, the Fourth Amendment, the number of Fourth Amendment violations is down and the police have become more of a trained, institutionalized force. All of that is true, and I think you would have some sort of protection for the really bad cases.
Yeah, and if we're going to put in a plug for originalism, which obviously we all are trying to do here, there is an outstanding originalist argument that qualified immunity is, to use a technical term, made up, and that, you know, the Congress that actually passed, you know, the relevant statutes went out of its way to say that it was displacing common law immunities, and that somehow got lost in subsequent codification. So, and I think what it illustrates, this whole area illustrates, that, you know, the problem with sort of judicial activism and departing from textualism and originalism is that once you depart, that sort of begets additional departures to make up for the fact that you departed in the first instance. So as the question alluded to, you know, the best argument for the exclusionary rule is that with qualified immunity, there's no remedy for Fourth Amendment violations. But of course, if you go back to first principles, you would have a remedy for the Fourth Amendment violation that would be fully available to somebody who's not a criminal defendant at all because they're an innocent homeowner that was mistakenly had their home unreasonably searched by the authorities. That person would have a cause of action. They wouldn't have to say that the violation was clearly established. They would just have a remedy. And then if you had that remedy, the argument for getting rid of the exclusionary rule would be much stronger. So it does sort of show when you deviate, it sort of begets future deviations. And so I like kind of Cam's suggestion that maybe a state legislature could tee this up by really, you know, not just kind of trying to get rid of the exclusionary rule, but couple it with a very robust civil remedy that has its particular applications to individuals who never end up being a criminal defendant at all. I think that would be a powerful statute that could tee up the issue pretty effectively.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, you'll be our last question.
Good morning. I'm Caitlin Deering. I'm an early career appellate lawyer, and I thought I'd take this opportunity to ask the panel, what is your best advice for preparing for oral argument?
So I can give some, the best advice that I got before the Scrimeti argument actually came from Cam, because, you know, when you're prepping for one of these big arguments, I was extremely nervous. It was my first Supreme Court argument. We had done all of these moots, and you have all of these smart people, these smart conservative lawyers who are asking you these questions at these moots. And after a while, you start to feel pretty dumb. And Cam had, early in the process, insisted to me that we not do an outside moot within the week before the argument. We did a consovoy-only moot, and Cam had clearly instructed everyone that they need to provide feedback like I was Paul Clement, okay? And so that actually was the best thing for me to kind of have that, like, confidence in when you're going in to the argument. So I think moots are very valuable, but I think in some of these big cases, it's useful to only have your team and not to have kind of outside thoughts from people who don't know the case as well as you do.
I'll just give one tidbit, which is, I think sort of, you know, a mistake you can make in getting ready for an argument is, you know, especially if it's a Supreme Court argument, especially if it's one of your early Supreme Court arguments, I mean, you were going to prepare and you're going to prepare and you're going to prepare. And so within a couple of days of the argument, you, like, know the case like nobody else on the planet. And there can be a tendency, because you still have, like, another couple of days before the argument, to start reading materials that are more and more tertiary to the actual case. And, of course, because you've read all the primary materials, you've read all the secondary materials, you've thought about this case, you start to look at some tertiary case as if it's, like, the Rosetta Stone that, like, unlocks everything. And I've literally seen, you know, once or twice, and only once or twice, but it was enough to see it to not ever try to do it, a lawyer get up and kind of, like, you know, try to start the argument by talking about some case that was only cited on page 35 of their brief. And so I actually think it's a good discipline in the last couple of days before the argument to just go back to the very primary materials, just reread the lower court opinion, reread the one or two Supreme Court cases that are most on point, and reread the briefs, and not sort of get yourself lost in tertiary materials as you get to the home stretch, which may be kind of a compliment to the idea that, you know, make sure your last moot court is a friendly one.
Yeah, and one way to do that, I think, in the same vein is talk to family, spouses, kids, you know, smart friends, even lawyers who are not working on the case. Kind of talk to them about the case a little bit if they'll listen to you. You'll see that you've already brought it down to basically what matters, and you don't want to get lost in the weeds, and you do want to tune out the outside voices towards the end. And just, I mean, the justices are the absolute best at answering the, at asking questions that are really difficult and posing hypotheticals. But if you notice, they're right on typically the four or five core issues that actually matter in the case, and that's what you need to be looking at and sort of in the lead up at the end.
I'd just say those are all great points. The thing I'd say is an observation, and it's maybe not for any particular oral argument, but it's something to think about over the long haul of oral arguments, and it's that oral arguments reveal character. They're very stressful, especially if you're in the Supreme Court or a very controversial case, and when you're under a lot of stress, you can't help but reveal who you are, and that's for better or for worse. You can hear advocates in very difficult cases, and you can tell if somebody's a jerk, if they shout out dissenting voices, if they're impatient, like all those things come out. So, I mean, I think it's great to know everything you can about the law, to be able to argue and brief and all those things, but you can't really, there's no replacement for character. So I'd say, especially to, you know, young law students, as you go through, build your legal skills, build your oral argument skills, but most fundamentally, build your character, because that will determine how far you go and how well you do, for better or for worse.
That's a very fitting end to our panel. Can we give them all a round of applause again?